You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It seems like just about every day or thereabouts, there's a new story or study about our declining attention spans, something we've talked about here on Central Time. A lot of times people blame technology. They say social media is rewiring our brains or our smartphones are making us oblivious to the rest of the world around us.
Our next guest says technology isn't the cause of the problem, but it's a symptom. He argues we're having the wrong debate about distraction, that the problem is that we're too autonomous with no direction for our attention. Matthew B. Crawford is here to explain what he means. He's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture and the author of The World Beyond Your Head on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you mean when you say that attention is a cultural problem?
Well, attention is this mental faculty by which we pick something out from all the stuff that's coming at us and say, that's important. And I think we've become kind of agnostic on the question of what's worth paying attention to, that is, what to value. And I think this is connected to our economic life, where we're bombarded with so many choices and options, and you know, the economists tell us that freedom consists of satisfying your preferences, and to discover your true preferences requires maximizing the number of choices you face. But this is precisely the condition that makes for maximum distraction and dissipation of your energies.
Are we also at a point where we need to think of our attention as a resource, the way we might think of clean water and clean air, something that's limited?
Exactly. I mean, attention is something we have only so much of, but we're not yet very articulate in making a claim for our attention on our own behalf. And just like clean air makes it possible to breathe, I think silence is a resource of just that sort, and it makes it possible to think, which is no small thing.
And you talk about silence as being something that's part of a sort of a common property, the commons, and also something for the common good. How do you make that case?
Well, when you're passing through an airport, it seems like every surface has been claimed for commerce, and you can shift in your seat and avert your gaze from the screens, but the fields of view that haven't been claimed by some technology trying to appropriate your attention are getting fewer and narrower. And of course, you can put on noise-canceling headphones if you're willing to spend $400 or whatever, but I think we need to sort of reclaim public spaces as being for the public. And I think there's a widespread sense that that the very idea of a public has been eroded, and that's connected to our sense that politics has been captured by narrow interests, so that any kind of public space feels like it's been turned into a mere surface for the display of enticements, to be somewhere else.
And you're right that I think it's in the luxury lounge of the Charles de Gaulle Airport that the luxury lounge is actually quiet. It's the only place where there isn't a lot going on by way of advertisements and media trying to get your attention. I guess that sort of suggests that the new commodity is silence and sort of simplicity and freedom to think in a way.
Yeah, it's offered as a luxury good. So at that business class lounge in Paris, all you hear is the occasional tinkling of a spoon against china. It's really lovely. And when you walk in there, your neck muscles relax, your brow unfurrows itself. The difference is almost tactile. It's like stepping out of haircloth into satin. And when you consider that it's those in the business lounge who are making the decisions that determine the character of the peon lounge, and you might start to see these things in a political light. Because to engage in the sort of playful, inventive thinking that you can when it's silent, maybe one thing you're coming up with is sort of brilliant marketing schemes to inflict on those on the peon lounge. So it's good to think of this as a transfer of wealth that's occurred when some people treat the minds of other people as a sort of resource that can be harvested by mechanized means.
Would you say that this is something that we, and by we I mean society, everybody is entering into willingly? We want to be connected. We want to know what's going on in various networks. We want to be part of the hubbub and the information that's available. If not, we might be left out from whatever it is, economic or social opportunity. So isn't this something we're kind of choosing to enter into?
Well, yeah, there's, of course, a big distinction between intrusive advertising and the things that we willingly invite into our lives. But some of those can sometimes be disturbing as well, because sometimes it's sort of hyper-palatable, if you want to call it that, mental stimuli like porn or Candy Crush, things that are sort of seem to tap into hardwired preferences our brains have. And these can be disturbing because they seem to crowd out other forms of engagement with our surroundings and with other people. So I think it's possible to make an analogy with fast food, just as food engineers figured out how to create things like Cheetos that are hard to resist by getting the levels of salt and fat and sugar just right. I think the media have become quite expert at creating stimuli that our brains are kind of hardwired to love. And so one sort of question that comes up is, if human experience is sort of much more saturated with these manufactured experiences that have been designed around us precisely in order to capture and hold our attention, I think it means that human experience has become a more engineered and therefore more manipulable thing.
We're talking right now with Matthew Crawford. He's the author of The World Beyond Your Head on Becoming an Individual in an Age of Distraction. Let's focus on the becoming an individual part of this, because part of what you say is that in a way it's too much autonomy that's creating the problem here. So how does that tie in with the prospect of becoming an individual?
Well, in the book, I present these case studies of people engaged in skilled practices. So I talk about hockey players, motorcycle racers, short order cooks, people who make glass, and people who make musical instruments. And one of the things that's really impressive in all of these skilled practices is that the people's mental energy seem to get gathered to a point, and they no longer are in this condition of having to exclude things by sort of mental discipline. It's almost like falling in love once you start to become competent in something. So, and one thing that stands out in all of these examples is that it's hard to understand them under the kind of rubric of freedom or autonomy. They're actually submitting to some discipline that has its own kind of imperatives to it. And, you know, to become a competent musician, you have to practice scales endlessly and sort of accommodate yourself to the mechanical realities of your instrument, whatever it may be. And in all of these examples, there's a feeling of joining the world beyond your head by becoming competent in something real. And that's very different than being a passive consumer of experiences that are kind of designed around you. But to throw yourself into something like that, you do have to initially be able to kind of free yourself from these more things that are immediately engaging. So there's a bit of asceticism required to get into it.
Right. You make it sound like a spiritual discipline. You sort of yoke yourself to something else, and that gives you the freedom to direct your attention. So are you saying we have to give up freedom in order to get it?
I think we need to be more self-conscious about how the language of freedom has been turned to manipulative purposes. It's become the language of marketing. You know, so the credit card offer says no limits or you're in charge. So it's a kind of sly appropriation of our most cherished ideal. You know, one can trace this to a certain picture of the modern self and what the dignity of the self requires, back in Enlightenment thought. It requires a certain independence from the surrounding world. And, you know, the language of marketing seems to offer that kind of freedom as something we're entitled to, whereas I think actual, I don't know, freedom's the right word, maybe agency tends to arise when we're engaged in something that makes demands on us. And it's not simply a matter of becoming independent of the world. It's more like throwing yourself into the world.
We're talking right now with Matthew Crawford. He's got a new book out called The World Beyond Your Head. We're talking about what he sees as our current crisis of attention.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Do you feel like your attention, your focus is a scarce resource? Do you feel like there's so many distractions, so many things to keep track of that you never actually do the thing that you want to do, the thing that you love? Do you think our attention spans are getting shorter? If so, why? And do you think we're too disconnected from the world around us, maybe from each other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion with author Matthew Crawford about his new book called The World Beyond Your Head.
And you can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. In a busy world with lots of distractions, have you found a way to tune it out, to concentrate on the thing you want to do? A craft, maybe. A long book. A relationship. What do you do to ignore life's daily distractions? Do you have tips for exploring what our guest calls the world beyond your head? Do you agree with our guest that we could use some help figuring out what to pay attention to and how to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Matthew, you talked about some professions and sort of these prolonged apprenticeships that some people have with a discipline, say like a jazz musician or a glass blower or a hockey player. Can we talk about one of those and how that sort of prolonged apprenticeship can actually help us learn what to focus on, what to pay attention to?
Yeah, well, I guess I can refer to my own experience. I started working on cars when I was young and worked at a Porsche shop. And then a few years later had a real mentor who taught me to rebuild VW engines. And one thing that stands out is just how involved he was in this. You could see the disgust on his face when, you know, someone had not done something right on an engine, or some subtle pleasure sort of flit across his face when he'd see something well done. And I think that's pretty typical, that when you go deep into some particular skill or art, you become really discerning about, you know, in this case, engines, whatever it might be. And I think it trains your powers of concentration and perception. And that's relevant for our economy because, you know, apprenticeship is something that's often criticized for being too narrow in education. It's said that everyone should be flexible, as though they shouldn't be burdened with any particular set of skills or knowledge. But it can have this effect of kind of you get initiated into an ethic of caring about what you're doing when you go deep into something. And that's arguably what makes someone really care about quality at a kind of visceral level.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Amelia joining us from Milwaukee. Amelia, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm a student and I go to school in D.C., university. And I'm just calling to talk about specifically, like you said, with education, there are changes from the idea of a liberal arts curriculum where you focus on a lot of different things, but having grown up with the internet and with the college application process is very competitive and very achievement-oriented, it seems that students my age, we really don't get to delve into one thing specifically. It's very rare. I know at my school, everyone's trying to have an internship as well as take a full course load and participate in four extracurriculars or something like that. And I think that leaves a lot of room for delving in the apprenticeship way or perhaps in a more traditional form of education.
Okay, thank you for your call, Amelia. And Matthew, what do you think about the different schools of education thought, you know, having a broad sort of liberal arts base or taking the time to go deeply into one or two things?
Well, I mean, ideally, you would do both. Of course, time is short, and we don't always have the luxury of doing everything. So, I mean, one of the rationales that's I guess, really the most prominent one for going to college is that, so that you can make a good living. But for the last, 5 years, there's an awful lot of unemployed college graduates. Meanwhile, people who become competent diesel mechanics or welders are in huge demand. So there are very good reasons to study the liberal arts that I think have nothing to do with earning a living. And as long as you're clear-sighted about that, go to it. I think it's also true that one can read challenging books in a context that's not the university. Personally, I didn't get seriously interested in books until after college. And, I meet a lot of people for whom that's the case. And it almost seems strange that those years of 18 to 22 would be the ones when you're supposed to have your head buried in a book, because that's when, the hormones are raging and you're trying to figure out all kinds of other dimensions of life that have nothing to do with scholarship.
Amelia, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate that. We're going to go next to Steve. Steve's joining us from Lake Geneva. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my early 50s, and I've been around the world. And I first noticed this in the late 1980s, early 90s, in places like Shanghai, Hong Kong, and then bigger cities in the U.S., and then eventually just kind of took over our society as I kind of dropped out from television and I had children, and I really give them a lot of space and time and silence so that they can think. What I see is it's about power and control, at least that's what I feel. Without being paranoid about it, it's very much, if you don't have the time to think for yourself, be in touch, whether it be with God or your own personal spiritual beliefs, or just make a good decision about what you're going to do with your life or your time or your day or even what show or book you're going to read, then that's about power and control. And when somebody has that and they don't give you that space to, for whatever reason, think for yourself or have that peace and quiet. I lived in a gang-ridden neighborhood for a while in Chicago, and constantly the boom boxes and the stereos were going in the cars, and I just said, it really blocks out cognitive thinking. It's all about just reaction then. And I found it very threatening, and I find it threatening in our society that it exists. It's so prevalent that we're just clawed at in so many ways. We just
Steve, thank you so much for that. Sorry to cut you off there. I just want to make sure we get a chance for a guest to respond. Matthew, what is the worth, as Steve was talking about there, of having that space to think clearly, to make decisions? What is that worth to an individual and to society?
I think it's true. We are clawed at. I like that expression that the caller used. And I think we're engaged in this constant low-level effort of excluding all these stimuli that are coming at us, and it's exhausting. It's a sort of a cumulative effect of feeling mentally fragmented and exhausted. And I also like what the caller sort of mentioned, the idea of control. When this is kind of hard to get at, but when we're all tuned into mass entertainments because they're so compelling, and let's face it, television has become awesome, it means it's very hard to devote yourself to something that isn't immediately engaging, like reading that difficult book or practicing a musical instrument, because the payoff isn't going to come until later. So I wonder if we're becoming more similar to one another, a kind of homogenization of human beings due to these stimuli that are designed precisely in order to capture and hold our attention.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for joining us and talking about your book today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Matthew B. Crawford. He's a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture, and he's also the author of the new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction.
I may try to put some of that into practice. I try to learn musical instruments or get better at them, and I'm really easily distracted. So I'm going to try to put this into practice and develop that focus. You?
I think everybody's guilty of that now,
yeah,
aren't they?
I
always want to put my smartphone down more and do, like you said, an instrument is a great example. Something for everybody to work on, I guess.